Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time road warrior.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that, again, buoyed by the return of our heart and soul, Mary Pat Truthart, marks each passing week by how many films we manage to fit into our seven-day calendars. This past week was no different, as among what we caught both on the big screen and at home, we counted two films that entertain the notions of time at their very core. The first is Conclave, a study of what happens when a Catholic pope passes away and the College of Cardinals sequesters itself until a new pope can be elected. The second is the aptly titled We Live in Time, a film about a couple who meet, fall in love, and then must find a way to weather the ups and downs of life in the time that fate gives them. Let's begin by heading to Rome's Vatican City. It is there that Cardinal Thomas Lawrence, played by Ralph Fiennes, is called to the apartment of the just-deceased pope. It is his job, as Cardinal Dean, to then call and oversee a conclave, which is a meeting of the College of Cardinals that will vote on who among them will be the next pope. Based on the 2016 novel by Robert Harris and directed by the German-born director Edward Berger, from a script by Peter Stroyan, Conclave immerses itself in the proceedings of the church, but with an eye more to suspense than to religious ceremony. Lawrence must oversee the election that features intrigue and infighting between various camps, conservative, liberal, and ultra-traditionalist, and the various ethical violations that ensue. Berger, whose 2022 adaptation of All Quiet on the Western Front was a powerful update to Erich Maria Remarque's 1929 novel. He uses his cast well enough, though Fiennes remains the quiet power in the face of the more obvious performances by Stanley Tucci, John Lithgow, and the Italian actor Sergio Castellitto. And he benefits mightily from the rich cinematography overseen by Stéphane Fontaine. In the end, though the film is expertly made, your reaction to Conclave is likely to depend on just how serious you are about your Catholicism, as opposed to caring about the controversies that have rocked the church in recent decades.
I found it intriguing that you talked a little bit about the fact that this wasn't about religious ceremony, Dan, when giving us an intro to Conclave, because it's not about religious ceremonies per se, but it's certainly about rituals associated with the papacy. And I think that anyone who was raised Catholic, is a Catholic, has these sort of notions of what this conclave process would be like.
So, and you should say that you were raised.
Yeah,
Catholic.
I mean, I think of myself going back to 1958 when we had this transition between Pope Pius XII to John the 23rd, and seeing the subsequent popes. We had a pope actually retire, unusually, in the relative recent past. And so there is all this sort of mystery behind what happens in these circumstances. So I have no idea if what is portrayed on the screen in Conclave bears a resemblance to how this actually plays out. But boy, it was very focused on the ritual and the power and the behind-the-scenes activities that I think does, in many respects, reflect a variety of organizations. And certainly the Catholic Church, although it may be reluctant to acknowledge it, is maybe the quintessential hierarchical organization going back millennia. So I think that you mentioned the cinematography, and I trust that each of you will discuss that a little bit more. It really is the performances here that make this film work. And I think it was entertaining. I don't know that it's ultimately satisfying. There's a twist at the end that we don't really want to talk about. And so that might work for some people or not for others. But it was really Ralph Fiennes' performance that is most notable here. And I've not been a huge Ralph Fiennes fan over the years. Cue the English Patient and Elaine on Seinfeld's discussion of that. But in Conclave, I mean, he was exactly the right age. He had exactly the right sort of persona, because he's someone who is struggling with his faith and has doubts about, you know, a variety of things. But yet the Pope, who's now deceased, had left him in charge of organizing this conclave. And so he's very equivocal about his role, but he's also trying to navigate this pathway among all the different factions, Dan, that you mentioned. And you find out that each of the potential candidates is going to have their own particular quirks or issues or problems or concerns. And I really enjoyed watching this movie, one, because it was beautiful in many respects, and because I disdain rituals. I love traditions, but I don't like rituals. So to see this so writ large, it was kind of like, whoa, almost overwhelming to me in some respects.
Well, and it feels appropriate, maybe even on the nose, that we're reviewing Conclave on election week, because I don't think this is a movie about Catholicism at all, even though, as you said, it uses a lot of these traditions as backdrops. And certainly it's using those things to make a point about customs dating back centuries and millennia, and how
I mean, like many, the Electoral College,
maybe, and how many of these governing bodies are stuck in those ways. This is really a story about cronyism. It's about corruption. It's about what it means if you're going to compromise your beliefs or your faith, if that's how you want to call it, if it means maintaining a bit of power within the institution that you're a part of. And obviously, all of those things definitely apply to the College of Cardinals, at least what we imagine it is. But it's not limited to this particular institution, obviously. And I haven't read Conclave, the Robert Harris novel this is based on, but I assume it's sort of a page turner in that,
like,
you know,
the Da Vinci
Code. Dan Brown mold. Exactly. Because it has that breathless pacing, despite it being mostly about conversations and kind of that sort of thing. And it has a lot of twists as it goes on. But this movie is also way better than any of the Dan Brown adaptations that we've seen, the Da Vinci Code. It is perhaps a bit too solemn in some ways, because let's face it, this is a potboiler, right? Like, is a movie, even though it does have things to say about faith and it does have things to say about the institution that it's about, this is ultimately a movie that is just going to pull you along with a story that has a lot of unexpected turns. And all of the supporting characters that sort of get their moment as the film goes on adds to those twists. So you mentioned Ralph Fiennes, but there's this really wonderful small part for Isabella Rossellini as one of the mother's superior who's overseeing this and making sure that all the all the table settings for the Cardinals are just right. But then there's a moment where she realizes, I can no longer sit idly by and not speak. I have to say something about what I'm witnessing here. And I really liked the performance of an actor named Carlos Diaz, who plays one of the candidates who comes from, he's been stationed in Kabul, and he shows up.
Whole story seemed a little improbable.
Well, but here's the thing.
That's the twist.
What I liked about that performance, though, first of all, who is that guy?
Right.
I looked him up. He's a first-time actor. He's never been in a movie before. He's a Mexican-born actor who lives in Vancouver. He started studying acting during the pandemic. He works at an architecture firm in Canada, and he got this role through an open casting call. And I think he has this kind of beguiling presence that's just right for that character.
I agree.
The reveal about what he's doing there and who he is and all of that stuff, without giving it away, at first it struck me as the kind of plot development that would be in a movie that's decades old at this point. But I think it ultimately leaves us with a pretty provocative question about what it means to be beholden to a kind of institution like this, and how an institution like this can evolve, or how your own feelings can evolve. So it left me with enough questions that I thought it was more provocative than I expected.
For me, the ending was both a little bit predictable and a little bit disappointing, because so much of it was this somber
exploration. I'm just going to say, I didn't think it was predictable, but...
No, I didn't either.
Well, I mean, not everything was predictable.
But I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And we haven't even mentioned the fact that there's like a terrorist cell near the Vatican, and violence outside, right, too, which,
I wanted to point out that if anybody's going to this thinking they're going to see another remaking of The Two Popes, that 2019 film with Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce, this is not that. This is more, as you say, kind of a Dan Brown kind of thing. And I wanted to point out, in terms of the acting, whenever I see Stanley Tucci and whenever I see John Lithgow, I see Stanley Tucci and I see John Lithgow. Fiennes, I think, becomes Lawrence. I really think. But another guy I wanted to point out was Lucien Mazmati, who plays the cardinal from Nigeria.
Yeah.
He has a really terrific scene in which he's told, hey, you got problems in your past, buddy.
Yeah,
so,
and they have come home to roost.
Yeah. But I think ultimately when it comes down to it, it is one of the most beautiful movies I've seen in a long time, just in terms of Fontaine cinematography. All these, you know, we can make fun of the people in robes and stuff, but boy, they sure look rich and nice.
Yeah, and we're cloistered in there with them. He gets that contrast between those deep, dark shadows. But then you go out to the courtyards or in those marble columns, and it's almost blinding. And so that contrast kind of shows what it's almost like it's reflecting the internal nature of what's happening here. So,
exactly.
it's a good movie.
Yeah. Any rate, that was our discussion of Conclave. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to debate the love story, We Live in Time. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Spokane Public Radio Listener Line.
I'm remembering when you first started. I was working in the Spokane Peace and Justice Center. We were talking about this new public radio, and wasn't it great that public radio was coming to Spokane? And I've always been appreciative of public radio ever since. And I'm just so grateful for public radio. Thank you so much.
509-232-6904.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed Edward Berger's film Conclave. Let's now move to something a bit more personal, if no less, well, timely. Tobias, played by Andrew Garfield, and Almut, played by Florence Pugh, meet in the cutest way possible. He, dressed only in a bathrobe, is hit by Almut's car. And when he awakens in a hospital corridor, the two meet and slowly, gradually fall into the kind of love affair that is far more believable than most movie romances you're apt to see. Directed by John Crowley from an original script by Nick Payne, We Live in Time is the kind of film that, in the hands of, say, someone with the sensitivity of novelist Nicholas Sparks, might become something cloying and cliché. Instead, Crowley, director of such films as Brooklyn and The Goldfinch, has crafted a film that smoothly navigates between past and present, that captures the heartfelt emotions of a couple caught up in the joy and angst of their mutual connection, and that features maybe some of the best acting that Garfield and Pugh have ever performed, which, considering their respective resumes at even such young ages, is saying something.
Yeah, the two performances at the center of We Live in Time are, I think, the best things about the movie, and certainly Garfield and Pugh are two of the best young actors working right now. Although Andrew Garfield's like in his 40s now and has been around for a couple decades, so maybe
but
not
he doesn't
so young.
Look.
Yeah, it's true. And a few things I liked about this movie. I liked the fact that in depicting their relationship, it doesn't shy away from sexuality in any way. It's still very tame. This is an R-rated movie, but it's not that R-rated. But so often we see on-screen romances that are just entirely sexless, like something out of a Nicholas Sparks novel or a Hallmark movie or anything like that. I appreciated that. I also thought that it depicted some really interesting things about what it means to face death head on, both the death of a loved one and your own mortality as well, that the Florence Pugh character does things near the second half of this movie that are pretty selfish and self-serving and is really focused on her drive to complete something that she feels like will give her life meaning before she goes. And I think that kind of behavior is a lot more common than we'd like to think, and you don't often see it in movies. And I
particularly
thought,
not know, something that's a romance, that's a love story, that's being sold as that.
Yes. And so I appreciated the fact that it showed that about her character, that it showed her doing something that might threaten to make her unlikable to the audiences. Yeah. And it actually endeared me more to the character in a weird way. I think the nuance of the romance and of those performances, though, I think is sort of undone by some of the plot elements that you've mentioned about We Live in Time, the cutesier stuff. Their meet cute, where she hits him with the car, is just so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. There's an almost sitcom style scene where They're driving to the hospital so Florence Pugh can give birth. And what do you know? They're stuck in a traffic jam. And, you know, the comic things ensue from there. There's some heartfelt speeches that feel very scripted. And I also want to talk a little bit about, and maybe we can get into this, but the chronology of the movie. I mean, it's right in the title, We Live in Time. You mentioned the fact that it isn't told in chronological order. But I also had an issue with the way that was done. It didn't feel particularly elegant to me, but maybe you can shed some light on that. So I'm
or disagree.
Yeah, or disagree. I'm mixed on this movie. The good stuff, though, is good. But I don't know. I really wanted to be like a weepy mess by the end of this. And I wasn't quite, although there were scenes that really did move me. And I think that comes from those two central performances.
And I thought this film, We Live in Time, was borderline insufferable. I mean, honestly, like,
I'm serious. We run the gamut here. Don't
right. I mean, it totally, I will loud the performances, but it totally lost me when we discover that this woman is equivocal about having children. Okay. Then she finds out she has ovarian cancer. So does she make the logical decision that I think most people would make under those circumstances, which is to have a hysterectomy? No, she decides not to do that. And so then, gee, surprise, surprise, you know, this cancer recurs. And I'm like, oh, wow, who would have ever guessed that? You know, I don't know. I couldn't buy into any part of this, really. I didn't like the chronology shifting. It didn't totally work for me. And I think that they needed to change that up just a little bit more so you could understand the time frame in which we were dealing. I mean, you could understand some of the things by the hairstyles and so forth. I liked the little girl. I thought that she was realistic when they were trying to tell her
they had a kid
important. Oh, yeah, they had a kid because why not? You know, I mean, I don't know. This did not work for me in any way.
I think part of her problem, though, was she was sitting next to a sniveling mess through the entire film.
That was you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
I had a feeling. I've known you long enough that I had a feeling this is how this was going to go.
Oh, yeah.
I had a sneaking suspicion that someone was going to be a sniveling mess during this movie and the other person was going to be rolling their
I was all the way, all the way
right.
through.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
you know, and I do recognize that there are problems with the film. I had no problems at all with the acting. I thought there was one scene in which Andrew Garfield is being told by the Florence Pugh character that she's thinking about not going through this, you know, she wants to live a good 6 months of her life rather than 2 years of pain. And the camera is on his face, and every expression that could possibly be done by anyone, befuddlement, pain, questioning, whatever, runs across his face. And I went, this guy's never been better. And Pugh herself has, you know, I mean, we've seen her in Little Women, for which she got an Academy Award nomination. And
Midsummer.
Midsummer. I mean, we've seen her do a series of roles.
Oppenheimer.
I don't think she's ever been better. She was just so good as this woman who was determined, maybe in a stupid way, but she was determined to do what she wanted to do. But then she gives in to her mate and, you know, signs.
Well, I don't know if she gave in to him in terms of his desire to have a child, but that really wasn't explained, her transition from being equivocal. I mean, she said at one point to her husband, you know, you're a good parent, or I can see you as a good parent. So I see how that could have shifted her mentality. But I mean, she was making this life and death decision as I saw it, and it just didn't seem realistic to me.
Well, I want to go back to the issue of the chronology, because We Live in Time is, it's not the sort of thing where a scene from the past will follow a scene from the present, a scene from the past, then a scene from the present, where you have that kind of like almost metronomic structure, nor is it done, you know, backwards in the way that something like Betrayal was done. It feels a little jumbled to me, and I get why you would tell this story in that way, where a scene from the past explains the characters in the present or in the future. Something from their past is now defining what we're seeing now. We've seen that in other movies like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, or 500 Days of Summer does that as well. It didn't feel as intentional to me here. It almost felt like they thought, well, if we tell this story in basic chronological order, it's just going to be another weepy melodrama, which I think the performances could have elevated it. And you look at John Crowley's best film, which is Brooklyn, the movie he made with Saoirse Ronan as the Irish immigrant coming to America in the 50s. That is a very traditional, old-fashioned melodrama, and yet it is made so rich and beautiful through the performances and the writing and just the nuance of the characters. And I feel like he could have still pulled it off this way, but I don't think the jumbling of chronology really serves the purpose that they wanted it to.
Yeah, and see, this is a point in which I disagree mightily with both of you because, you know, I've seen many of these films that are done awkwardly. I had no problem at all following the story, following the timelines.
I'm not talking about following it. That has nothing to do with it. I'm saying if you're going to use this particular device, it needs to have, I think, at least some kind of emotional resonance. And to me, it just wasn't pulled off well. It wasn't that I was confused by the chronology of it. Even look at the movie we did, speaking of Saoirse Ronan, that movie she did, The Outrun, which was also told in a jumbled chronology. To me, that made more sense with the kind of story that was being told, even though I was lost as to where are we in this time frame. It worked for me in that
Well,
sense.
And I think that part of the difficulty here is we didn't have a frame of reference. So it wasn't told from anyone's point of view. At least that's how I felt. And so we're sort of above, like, looking in on what's happening here in this sort of unusual way that, you know, we get some insights into who they are. I didn't really understand a whole lot about his character ultimately.
Yeah, we didn't ever really learn very much. He's the Weetabix guy. He's the face of Weetabix and wherever
he's
he goes.
He's gone through a divorce at the beginning of the movie.
We know that.
Yeah. Right, but we don't know a whole lot.
And we know he has a good relationship with his father.
Yes, and he's constantly taking notes, so we know that he's fastidious in a way that maybe she isn't. She's certainly more
she's the creative.
Impulsive.
He's right.
Yes, we get that.
I do want to mention there is an incredible, albeit somewhat improbable, birth scene in this movie that actually I did like.
I liked
the secondary characters in that scene. For whatever reason, it seemed as unlikely as the scenario would be, I liked their participation.
Yeah, and we were just complaining about the last film, Conclave, that there was no humor in it. And here we have humor. It was, and I appreciated it. So, you know.
I think there is a little humor in Conclave.
It's dry humor.
It's very dry, yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So ultimately, three very different viewpoints.
Yes, but I think we can all agree that the two performances are good, right?
Absolutely. Good, the performances are terrific. At any rate, that was our discussion of We Live in Time. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbin and Mary Pat Truthart and I discussed Conclave. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot, on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words, most appropriately, from the late Mother Teresa. Yesterday is gone. Tomorrow has not yet come. We have only today. Let us begin. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.